this case on the record. And I also want to remind counsel that we have a complex algorithm to decipher who's going to argue which issue when. The issues can be viewed as interwoven, so as we will not feel constrained by only asking questions about one or two issues in part one or one and two issues in part two, you should not feel constrained by consulting with counsel in the middle of your portion of the event. Understood? So if you need more time to go over and say, you know, this is partly your issue nine or whatever it is, please do that and take the time you need to do that. Okay. At this point, the court calls United States v. Akbar. Counsel for the appellant, please.
May it please the court, Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Potter, along with Major Aaron Ingram and Major Jacob Bayshore, on behalf of the appellant, Sergeant Hassan Akbar. The sentence to death in this case is unreliable because of inexperienced and untrained trial defense counsels, numerous failures of constitutional implication. I would like to discuss three of those failures here today. One, failure to prepare witnesses for trial. Two, failure to present what they had in any meaningful way. And three, introducing the diary, which eviscerated the defense's flawed theory of mitigation in this case. Major Inkerbrandt will address counsel's failure to challenge panel members, and thus they seated a biased panel, and he will also discuss improper argument on the part of the government. Dr. Gary Southwell gives us a real mirror into the preparation of the trial defense counsel's case. Dr. Southwell was a psychologist who was part of the sanity board in this case and was suspected to be probably a government witness as the trial went on. In late February of 2005, trial defense counsel for the first time contacted Dr. Gary Southwell and Dr. Diebold, the other mental health professional working for the government on the sanity board, contact both of them and say, we need you to testify. They tell both of them that they are going to be vital to the defense's case and are the most likely witnesses to save Sergeant Akbar's life. In part, that was explained the diary, we believe. However, Dr. Southwell has provided a declaration, which is at JA3029, that states he was not interviewed until the middle of trial. So the defense had not prepared their mitigation case when this trial started.
Counsel, are you open for business now?
I am open for business, Your Honor.
You started with not interviewing or preparing witnesses for trial, and is that the order in which you think your arguments are strongest?
No, Your Honor, it's not the order. We think it's more gives a view into the entire defense case. We think the diary is there's no reasonable tactical reason to submit the diary. We do think the absolute lack of preparation of any civilian witnesses in this case is also very strong.
What about the length of the mitigation case? Is that in its own right noteworthy, or just when paired or compared or tied to the other alleged errors you've indicated?
Your Honor, it's extremely noteworthy. We believe that all these other errors are the reason it was a 38-minute defense presentation. And that was 38 minutes of tape, not 38 minutes of actual testimony. Approximately a quarter of the way through this argument will be the extent of the defense case. And we're doing 2 hours today. They did 38 minutes of the argument. And that's because they didn't prepare witnesses. And did not prepare for this trial.
Issue 8 is an issue about guidelines and so on, but just could you set the table, because you've indicated in your view where witness fell short, but shouldn't you start with what the standard by which we should evaluate their performance, and isn't that issue 8?
That is issue 8, Your Honor. I'm happy to discuss it.
And I don't want to mess up your presentation.
It's a presentation of whatever the court wants, so we'll focus on issue 8.
I wouldn't focus on it, but I would set the table to make sure that we know the standard by which we should evaluate your arguments on 1 and 2 and so on.
Hey, Your Honor. The ABA guidelines are lenses for which this court should view performance in courts martial for capital cases. The ABA guidelines apply in almost every federal circuit, and they would probably apply in all of them if all of them had actual capital cases. They apply in almost every state or some version of them. They are a lens in which you can judge counsel performance.
What is the current standard for evaluating counsel performance in the military circuit?
Your Honor, we believe it is the guidelines. This court in Loving 2006 mentions the guidelines. Kreutzer mentions the guidelines. We believe the guidelines are a tool. They're not inexorable commands, but a tool in evaluating.
Isn't Strickland the standard?
Pardon?
Isn't Strickland the standard?
Strickland's standard, Your Honor, but...
Isn't Strickland the constitutional standard?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But this...
The guidelines come from some extrajudicial source, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
But the Supreme Court has applied the guidelines in Wiggins, in Williams v. Taylor, have mentioned them in Sears v. Upton. Supreme Court has used the guidelines in assessing performance
Are you arguing that they should inform the evaluation or that they set the standard for the evaluation? I just want to be clear about that.
The Supreme Court has said they inform the evaluation.
And are you asking for more than that?
We are not. The amicus brief, Your Honor, believes that there should be an application of the standards. We have not gone that far. We believe that it informs the standards in a capital case. We believe numerous of the ABA guidelines in this case were not adhered to.
Does the military have guidelines for death penalty cases outside of they obviously don't have the ABA guidelines, but does the military have death penalty guidelines?
No, Your Honor, it does not.
Should it?
We believe it should, yes. We believe that the policy argument made by the amicus in this case, that in fact there should be guidelines.
Do they necessarily need to have ABA guidelines? Is there something about the military that would distinguish the ABA guidelines from military practice, for example?
Yes, Your Honor, they don't have to follow precisely. Each state has done the same thing. They have developed their guidelines to meet the circumstances of the practice that they have in that jurisdiction.
Counsel, when we're looking at the Strickland standard and the reasonably fallible attorney, are we looking at that in a capital case in this situation? And then also, is that standard different for practice in the military?
Your Honor, it should not be different for practicing in the military. The Eighth Amendment and effective assistance of counsel should be the same in the military as it is outside the military. We should not put soldiers to death with less qualified, less capable, less trained counsel, and with procedures that are not adhering to that which other courts in this country use.
And when we're looking at the attorney, are we looking at them in the context of a capital case or in the context of all representational cases?
Your Honor, we believe that Loving says you have to look at them with the lens that it is a capital case. The 2006 Loving case looked at the ABA guidelines, looked at the performance, and said we have to look at this case as it's a capital case. We understand Strickland still applies, that is still the standard, but there is a different gloss on it with a capital case.
Now, and this is getting off this subject a little more general, I noticed that your arguments, particularly today and also in your brief, seem to focus or concentrate more on the sentencing aspect of the case. Is that an accurate impression that I have? I mean, not to say that you don't have other arguments, but the emphasis seems to be on sentencing.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe the greatest failures in this case were on sentencing. It seems that the trial defense team in this case did the exact same thing the team did in Murphy, which was put least experienced counsel in charge of mitigation. They didn't travel. They made the exact same errors that trial defense counsel did in Murphy. And we believe that a team that was better experienced and better prepared would have put the senior counsel in charge of mitigation.
Well, didn't they start out with a better experienced panel and his mother fired him?
That's correct, Your Honor, but despite the fact that...
And then she retained civilian counsel, and then he left, then she retained other civilian counsel, and she didn't pay him, and he left. So where are we?
Well, Your Honor, we're still at the same spot. Porter v. McCollum, the trial defense counsel in Porter v. McCollum was a standby counsel in that case. He wasn't even, Porter was representing himself. And halfway through the trial, Porter says, I don't know how to do sentencing. That attorney in Porter v. McCollum was held to the same standard to give effective assistance to counsel, even though Porter had been...
Well, but you're not talking about, your previous comments went to experience. And all I'm saying is they had experience until Mom intervened.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the significant in this case is trial defense counsel did not, the ones that actually tried the case, did not seek out, except for one training course, any other experience.
They both had specific training in capital litigation, did they not? It may not have been lengthy, but they did have specific. My reading of the record is they both had specific training in capital litigation.
Your Honor, one of them went to a defense course. The other one did not. He went to a course at the Naval Justice School in around 2000-2001 that I attended, and it was not for trial defense counsel at all. It was more guided to just, here's the military justice system. Issues that might arise, but it wasn't defense-oriented. They never had training in, that counsel never had training in jury selection, mitigation, none of those factors that are part of a capital case that generally are not part of other cases.
Counsel, what should we read into the fact that Congress has demonstrated when it was passing legislation having to do with the military tribunals that they would impose a learned counsel requirement? Here, Congress has not imposed a learned counsel requirement here. So what should we read into that fact about whether we as a court should act in that regard?
Your Honor, I think you should look at it in this way, in that military court-martials are already expected to incorporate those practices that are being engaged in federal courts across the country. So federal courts are already using the guidelines as tools to evaluate performance. So this court should do the same as those federal courts.
Now, not all federal courts use those guidelines, though, correct?
Well, Your Honor, most every court that has been faced with the issue, whether the guidelines apply or not, and I use the apply term in measuring performance, have adopted the guidelines as applying. They look through the same lens. They're forced to because that's where the Supreme Court precedent is, Your Honor. One thing we know these untrained counsel did not do was actually interview one civilian witness before the trial began. They did talk to a few people on the phone. We do know that. But we know that they didn't interview anybody or prepare anybody to testify before the trial started. We have the one witness they put on in findings that was a civilian from Sergeant Akbar's past, was Paul Tupac. He was not interviewed until the night before he testified. He was not otherwise prepared to trial. Dan Duncan was not prepared to testify at all. He arrived on the night before he was to testify, arrived at the courthouse, was told where to sit, and said, we're going to ask you some questions. He performed his role in it. That 38-minute presentation, and then he left. He was not prepared at all. We also know that appellants, Sergeant Akbar's sisters, trial defense counsel never interviewed them at all to see if they wanted to testify or were able to testify. Both of those witnesses would have been powerful because they would have told the panel that Sergeant Akbar raised them as children. He was their father figure because their father was not home and mother was often gone. They lived in rugged circumstances, but he's the one that made it, got them into school, and kept them in school. That's powerful mitigating evidence.
Is it your position, then, that if mitigation specialists were to interview witnesses, that would not be sufficient, that it must be where trial defense counsel actually interviews potential witnesses?
Not in all cases, Your Honor, but in this case, yes, because what they did is they did interview witnesses to assess credibility. They said their defense case was devastated by the stabbing incident, But as we've shown in the record, that just is simply not true. Defense counsel had a witness list on 15 March that already had the witnesses that they said they lost because of the staffing incident not on that list. They had already dispensed with those witnesses without interviews, without preparation. All they had were the notes that the mitigators had assembled, and they had already dispensed with those witnesses with no phone calls. So they were left with no meat to the bones of the case. We believe that is partly because of the Dr. Southwell failure. When they brought Dr. Southwell in and he wasn't able to give them what they want, they were left without a mitigation case. And they brought Dr. Southwell in the middle of trial.
Your brief has a lot of woulda, coulda, and shoulda in it. If they had put on X, this might have caused one member to vote otherwise. But that's not the standard. Argument about the tactics of trial counsel isn't the standard. You've got to show us how it fell below the level required of counsel, who are presumed to be competent, and how that failure prejudiced the appellant. And just giving a list of witnesses that should have been called doesn't necessarily do that.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's not all we have. For example, we do have what they did put in or put on. We had this. They gave the panel this, including Sergeant Akbar's diary, to read overnight.
But counsel, when you say this, are you referring to the documents that were provided to the members?
Yes, Your Honor.
The so-called
So this is the diary.
The diary, yes, Your Honor. They gave the panel that, and then they told the panel, without any guidance, look through that and see what you can find that's mitigating. And if you read through those documents, Your Honor, there's much more aggravating than mitigating. And it's precisely what
should have they done?
They should have brought in, first of all, Your Honor, they should have brought in lay witnesses to lay the foundation for his life story. They should have brought in John Akbar, who could have testified about a lot of where the thoughts in that diary came from.
Wasn't he in jail most of the time? Akbar was a child. What's he going to testify to?
Your Honor, that's precisely what mitigating evidence is.
No.
That
I wasn't there, so therefore?
No, Your Honor. I was there for 5 years. I spewed this vitriol in my son's ear while he was developing. We had a religious crisis in the family where my wife and I were fighting about our religion. He heard all of this. He was forever tainted by that. That is my fault.
Counsel, I have one question there, though. In this case, appellant didn't allegedly commit this crime when he was 18 or 17 or 19. He was in his early 30s. He had been in the military for a number of years. He had not committed any offense approaching this. So doesn't that greatly attenuate this argument that his father, through when he was 5 years old, somehow twisted his psyche to such an extent that it went through his entire lifetime?
Your Honor, the source of the religious extremism and the racial extremism, what came from Father John Akbar, and John Akbar admits that, came from the Rankins family, Bernita Rankins, who was another witness that was never called, says there was racial animosity in the Rankins family.
But my point is, wasn't Akbar capable of conforming his conduct in accordance with normal society expectations until he was 32 years old?
That's correct, Your Honor. That is for the findings portion of the trial. That's very, very relevant. But mitigation is broader than that. It's broader than just the notion of whether he can conform or not. You have to explain the client's life. You have to change the story. Trial defense counsel never did that in this case. They never really attempted it. You have to say, he has family members who love him. They actually care enough to come into court and say this, and they want his life spared. He has reasons why he ended up with these racist and religious thoughts. And I am the reason for that, because I taught him very poorly. Don't take it out of my sense of what I did wrong.
So in your view, was it completely unreasonable for trial defense counsel to look at somebody like John Akbar, to look at his mother, Karan Bilal, and say, I am not going to be able to control these people on the witness stand, and they are likely to say something that is going to open the door to the allegations that Akbar stabbed the MP mere days before this trial occurred?
Two answers to that, Your Honor. First of all, we have diverging stories in this case. This is one of those cases that this case needs to have, Judge Everett would put it, to salt down the facts. Because we have two divergent stories here. John Akbar says they never discussed with me testifying. All the mitigation specialists that worked this case said he was a splendid witness. He was the perfect kind of person you would have put on the stand. We won't argue that Karan Bilal might not be controllable. But John Akbar, everybody said that he was controllable. Mushayat, Sultana, Bernita Rankins, all these people were witnesses that the mitigation specialists thought would be great witnesses. They never interviewed a one of them, Your Honor, or prepared them for trial. They met John Akbar. Scarlett Neurath says while she was on the case from October until February, trial defense counsel only met two potential witnesses, and that was Karan and John Akbar because they were attending hearings. They met nobody else. They traveled nowhere to meet a witness. They did nothing to prepare for this trial.
Counsel.
Oops. Chief.
I want to move you back to 8 again. What is a learned counsel, and are there learned counsel in the military judge advocate system?
Your Honor, I would think there are one or two learned counsel now that would maybe get to that point. Learned counsel are counsel that have had preferably experience knowing the proper ways to seat a panel. So voir dire is very important. It's a specialized field. Know how to work with mitigation specialists.
Is there a definition somewhere?
There is not. It's really from case law.
So the definition is as you present it, as one would present it?
You
know it when you see it,
you
but
know
you
it
can't.
When you see it. Yes, Your Honor. I think that's pretty much what the cases have said. We know that learned counsel can still be ineffective, but we also know they get much more deference in their decision-making.
What are the hallmarks of learned counsel when you said there might be only one or two in the military? The military is full of fine lawyers. Why are only one or two learned?
Your Honor, because they just don't have the experience in trying capital cases.
How many capital cases are there that they can get the experience in?
Your Honor, not many.
Not many.
Therein lies the rub. And there are other ways the Army could handle this as a policy matter.
Can you become learned by education?
You could become learned by education, Your Honor. They could train up these counsel too. I believe some of the counsel that have tried some other cases have gotten there through that means. These counsel just didn't do that.
And in your case, from your standpoint, where would we look to find the best definition, and I'm sure the government would have their own view, of what a learned counsel is?
I think
you've described some attributes, but courts tend to look to case law or law.
I would think the Johnson case out of Iowa talks about a learned counsel. That's a learned counsel that failed, but still talks about learned counsel. I think you can look to the ABA guidelines. The ABA guidelines define what counsel should be able to do, and a learned counsel should be able to do what the ABA guidelines state or give a good tactical reason to deviate from that. What's interesting, Your Honor, is that counsel in this case lists a bunch of sources that they relied on in preparing for trial. They didn't rely on the ABA guidelines. It's not one of the sources. There's no recognition.
Are you saying that's per se IAC?
No, Your Honor. We're not saying there's. You still have to look at the facts of the case, but we have a 38-minute sentencing
case. Okay, one of the reasons they had a 38-minute sentencing case was that when they put him up for his unsworn statement, he didn't give the unsworn statement and basically said something that has been described as insulting to the members.
Then, Your Honor, it would have been about a 45-minute presentation. This is a capital case, Your Honor.
This is a capital case, and you put him up, and that's what he does.
Counsel, what significance, if any, should this court draw from the fact of the panel came out and told the judge that reconsideration was proposed?
I think that's extremely significant, Your Honor. That shows that this was not a lost cause. This was a case that could have ended with a life verdict.
First, let me ask you, did the military judge provide instructions in that context correctly?
We allege that he did not, Your Honor.
Thank you, but what? Why?
I can get back to you on rebuttal on that, Your Honor. If you're prepared to address that on rebuttal.
Please.
Now, counsel, are you going to have an opportunity to discuss the diary issue? Or is that going to be handled at all?
I was planning on discussing the diary. The diary is inflammatory, Your Honor, and it was used by the government in closing argument. It was not used by the defense except to refer to it. There was nothing that they did to explain the diary or to put it in context. Every expert that we've had look at this case has said that is not the way that business should be done in a capital case. In fact, they encourage using lay witnesses to actually introduce that kind of testimony. In this case, it was just they just gave it to the panel.
So what's the prejudice that you're pointing
out? The prejudice, Your Honor, is we believe it's a counter to the defense theory. The defense theory was that he has sleep apnea, he has a mental illness problem, and some of his NCOs were abusive towards him. And therefore, he acted out. This diary shows exactly the opposite. He has statements in there, I wanted to destroy the United States since I was a child. I want to kill Caucasians. And these are from long before when he was in the Army. Some of these are statements while he was in college. And we know that Ruth Sachs could have identified some of those statements and put them in context. But once again, she's another witness that was never interviewed to the extent of seeing what she could testify to. She was only interviewed to see if she verified what Scarlett Neerad said, and then she didn't have notes, so they said, we're not going to call you either.
Well, she couldn't even remember him, could she?
Well, Your Honor, once again, that's a factual disparity. We have a declaration from her that says she did remember him.
After her recollection was refreshed by the mitigation specialist?
No, Your Honor, she says, I remembered him well. And it's not surprising. She says that he was different than a lot of other students she saw because he came in and he was referred to her, and that's clear from the notes, Dr. Ibarra's notes. So the counsel should have been aware of Dr. Sachs, that she wasn't a figment of mitigation specialist's imagination. But
I'm not saying she's a figment. Obviously, she exists. But the portions of the record I read seem to indicate that she couldn't remember it.
Well, Your Honor, if you read her declaration, that's not what she says. And we'll be happy to submit more declarations that even clarify that further. She remembered him well. She said he was one of those students that didn't just come in, check the block, and say, I've been to my counseling. That's all. He kept coming back because he had anger issues, and she remembered him well.
Chief, I see time has run.
Questions
I had
more
questions about
please.
The diary issue. May I?
Yeah, of course.
In regard to the diary, the government had already cherry-picked quotes from that diary.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, in your viewpoint, though, it was still unreasonable for defense counsel to introduce the entirety of the diary, which could have gone to show the increasingly disordered thinking of Akbar?
Yes, Your Honor, it was, because it was counter to what their theory was in the case, that this was all...
Can I be clear, is the problem that they introduced the diary or they introduced it without some context? Are you saying just if they had 14 people put it in context, if the problem was putting the diary in?
That may have been reasonable, Your Honor, depending on what those witnesses could what kind of context they could put it in. But the way they did it in this case was clearly not reasonable, just giving it to the panel and saying, make with this what you can.
Now, didn't they also, though, introduce Ms. Gray's analysis of the diary?
They did, Your Honor, and that
so doesn't that put it into context?
No, Your Honor, because that only put into context the most damaging and never highlighted the real mitigation. Both documents that they put in did not highlight mitigation. There was nothing. Nobody ever highlighted for the panel where the mitigation was in the diary. Dr. Woods did not do that. Those two reports do not do that. They just handle what's most aggravating. It's significant that the government used the diary in their sentencing argument. The defense never referred to any statements in the diary in their defense argument. It was purely the government. And the government took three of those statements that were pre-Sergeant Akbar being in the Army, and actually back when he was seeing Dr. Sachs at UC Davis, and used those statements. So it was out of context of what the defense had used the diary for, would have used the diary for anyway. It just built the government's case. And that's clear from the argument they engaged in. They were happy the diary was in.
Okay, counsel, there are no further questions at this time. You'll have some time on rebuttal, and if necessary, we can expand that to address the questions of the court. Counsel for the government, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Major Ken Bornino, and along with Captain Daniel here, we represent the government. This case is not only about 38 minutes of the trial. This case is about the complete 767 days that appellant's trial defense counsel dedicated their lives to saving his. It is the 57 substantive motions filed by the defense, the dozen witnesses called during trial, the dozens of witnesses interviewed pre-trial, and the 1,000 pages of documents reviewed in preparation for trial. It is about the objectively reasonable trial strategy chosen and effectively implemented by the trial defense counsel, arrived at after a thorough investigation of both the offenses and appellant's background. And that's the key to this case. The Supreme Court has provided us with interesting case law in recent years concerning IAC claims. And you'll see that whenever the defense raises a claim of IAC, the defense is going to cite Wiggins and Sears. When the government responds, we're going to cite Richter and Penholster. And the primary difference between those cases comes down to the investigation conducted by the defense counsel and what information they were aware of. When you look at Wiggins and Sears, the case turns on the fact that the defense counsel were not aware of significant pieces of information that were out there that were potentially mitigating or could have been utilized in either formulating a strategy or used at trial. That's not what we have in this case. Appellant has failed to come forward with showing a single fact of substance that his trial defense counsel did not know. Everything throughout his brief that he wants to talk about, Appellant's life history, Appellant's upbringing, all the problems that he had as a child and growing up through high school and into college, Appellant's trial defense counsel were already aware of all of that information. So this isn't like Wiggins and Sears that we're talking about. We're on the side of Richter and Penholster when we're looking at how we evaluate this claim.
The military has guidelines for just about everything.
Correct, Your Honor.
But apparently not for death penalty cases.
No.
Is there a military reason why there should not be guidelines for handling a death penalty cases by defense counsel in the military?
Well, I guess there are two sides
to that. Which is not the same as asking ABA guidelines, it's just guidelines. It seems to me it would provide some protection to defense counsel from IAC claims, among other things.
True, Your Honor. And I think there are two sides to that. And I think when we're talking about standards, there are the two pieces of that. There's the initial qualification standard is the one side, and then there's the standard as to, you know, reasonable standard of care. Like, what are you supposed to do in the conduct of your representation of an accused? And as to the first issue with regard to the qualifications of counsel, and I think this court is a lot of case law discussing the fact that those are not appropriate for the military based on the unique aspect of the military, particularly assignment patterns, the fact that the military is a tribe in the capital cases. It would be very difficult for the military to ever put forth someone who would meet strict guidelines, such as you would see in the ABA guidelines, or such as, you know, you might see at the commissions.
So a lesser standard is acceptable in the military, is what you're saying?
It's not a lesser standard, Your Honor. We still require qualification, and I think we still fit within the framework of Strickland, because what Strickland states is that, no, there are no set guidelines that should be employed for purposes of the constitutional analysis.
When we apply Strickland to this, are we looking at the military practice in the military, or are we looking at practice throughout society?
I think, you know, with the context of a capital case, you look at both. Obviously, most times you're looking at military practice within the military, but obviously capital cases, most of which are being done not in the military, I think you can also look to the civilian practice for how counsel represent accused in those circumstances. So it is the reasonable, like, natures of...
Is there a different standard for the military than there is in a civilian capital case?
In what a counsel is supposed to do in representation?
Yes.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Okay. I believe that the standards are essentially the same. Dealing with qualifications, the standard may be different. We're not going to set forth a specific you know, bullet list of qualifications you're required to have in order to track applications, because that would be very difficult. But when we look at the review of...
Well, it wouldn't be very difficult depending on what you put in them.
Correct, Your Honor, and it would be.
But right now, the military seems to have no qualifications, right? No guidelines.
It has not set forth guidelines, so we just rely on the standard set forth in Strickland, which is just viewing the performance of counsel, the actual performance of counsel under a reasonable standard. So we're not setting forth specific guidelines to be a retained counsel. And I think Strickland discusses the fact that every great attorney tries their first case at some point, and every attorney is going to try a case differently. So the fact that someone may have a great resume detailing all this experience doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to provide better representation than someone who maybe doesn't have as great a resume. And that's why we look to the representation itself to determine whether or not it was effective. Because if we're just looking at the qualifications, we could decide IAC claims before trial ever starts. We could just look at your resume and say, well, you're going to provide an effective...
Should there be a minimum number of courts martial that someone had litigated, for example?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Just work back from reasonableness. Go right to Strickland.
Correct, Your Honor. Because some of the best attorneys may have tried their first case. And some
and
of
never
the
mind if that happens to be a death penalty case.
Correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, does this court have the authority to develop requirements, standards that would apply?
To set forth guidelines for that particular purpose, Your Honor. I don't think that this court would have the prerogative to set forth that standard. I think that that's left to Congress and the President if they so choose. You know, as you pointed out, Your Honor, with regard to the commissions, you know, Congress set forth the framework as to what is required for qualifications.
What if the guidelines are pegged to constitutional due process or the Eighth Amendment?
Well, if they are the specific guidelines, the specific requirements are tied to some sort of constitutional requirement, then perhaps this court can start to state that it is a constitutional requirement that you have this experience, that you have tried 50 cases or you've tried at least 10 capital cases. If that's a constitutional requirement, then obviously this court has discretion to begin to point out that, you know, that is a...
I was just testing the breadth of your response.
Right.
And are you familiar with any case law in any other jurisdiction where that would be done?
No, Your Honor. And that was what I was going to point out, that that's not actually, there's no constitutional tie to specific guidelines. And that's what Strickland comes forth with. It's the after-the-fact review of counsel's performance, and it's the actual performance that is reviewed.
Now, counsel, I was a little bit concerned when you first started off. You seemed to almost be raising the bar even higher than the case law out there, saying that it's virtually unchallengeable if defense counsel know the lay of the land and make informed decisions. You almost seem to be saying that if they research the issue and make informed decisions, that it is per se unchallengeable. Did I misread your statements?
No, sir. No, Your Honor. It's not per se unchallengeable, but it's, of course, challengeable. And I think the Supreme Court and other courts talk about you have to do the probing inquiry into the actual strategy. And it's judged under an objective standard of reasonableness. So the court obviously looks at it objectively. So you don't just check the block saying that they knew about it, and obviously that's okay. You still need to look at the actual strategy and whether the strategy is reasonable, but you also look at it through the prism of the presumption of effectiveness of counsel and the presumption of the reasonableness of the trial strategy. And the courts are loath to second-guess the trial strategy because of the fact that we don't want to get involved in it. What Strickland points out is we don't want to get involved in this Monday morning quarterbacking and a panel of judges deciding that their opinion is better than what the trial defense counsel decided at the time.
Then can you please address what appellate defense counsel referred to at the beginning of argument about how trial defense counsel did not properly prepare these witnesses even before the stabbing of the MP, and therefore really wasn't in a posture to make an informed decision. And that seems to be also an allegation by Ms. Neerad, and I'm talking about we mitigation specialists had to interview these witnesses. Trial defense counsel never did.
Correct, Your Honor. And the short answer to that, a lot of that depends on what witness we're talking about in preparation and why they may not have necessarily gone in to prepare that witness in depth. But the long answer, really, Your Honor, is the fact that... sorry, I lost my train of thought. But essentially, what we have is the defense in their affidavit described their strategy and how they went about conducting the investigation. So they described how the mitigation specialists were the primary people who went out first to interview the family members, the extended family members, and the friends, collect these documents. So they did the initial review. They then passed all this information off to the defense counsel, who reviewed it. And what they said is, you know, the ones that they found interesting, the ones they found or most compelling and helpful for their case, they were the ones they began to follow up with to determine whether or not they were going to actually be good witnesses. So I think that that is one of the key aspects here. You know, there's no question that the defense counsel spent a lot of time preparing Dr. Woods, spent a lot of time preparing the case with, you know, all the soldier witnesses who were called, who knew appellant, who saw all this strange behavior. They spent time when they found him talking to Dr. Tucum. All this mental health evidence is what they focused on because this became the theme of their case. And I believe that what comes out of it is defense counsel decries the fact that they didn't spend more time preparing family members or interviewing family members. But the defense counsel were aware of what these family members were going to say and what they could offer in evidence from what the mitigation specialists were uncovering. I believe the decision was made, and what they're pointing out is that the decision was made that they did not believe that that evidence was necessarily helpful to their theme and trial. So they probably didn't necessarily feel that they had to contact Masjid Akbar in detail to discuss the case with her, discuss her potential testimony, because they knew what she was planning to say. And they decided that that's not something that's going to support our case anyways. So, you know, defense counsel point out the fact that it's okay to rely on mitigation specialist interviews. You know, that's a standard of care. You, defense counsel are allowed to rely on other people who conduct their own interviews to inform them as to what people are going to say. One of the primary reasons why we want defense counsel to interview people in particular is the credibility issue. You want to be able to judge how good are they going to be on the stand, how are they able to present themselves through demeanor. But if defense counsel know from the facts of what this person is going to say that they're never going to call them anyways, or that they would not necessarily plan to call them anyways, then there's really no need that they have to spend in-depth time interviewing them for demeanor and candor.
To what extent, though, should this court be concerned about a process whereby defense counsel could go through with each and every witness and find a goblin hiding behind the curtains and ultimately says, we're not going to call any witnesses? You have 2 days of very powerful, aggravating evidence, and then you have 38 minutes. To what extent, then, if you have a defense counsel who said, with every single witness we could have called, there was a problem. They could have opened the door to evidence that was extremely damaging. Would we have to, as a court, sit back and say, there just was such a disparity between the aggravating evidence that was put on before the panel and the mitigating evidence that there no longer can be this presumption in favor of letting the decision entirely rest with trial defense counsel about the appropriateness of putting on witnesses?
No, Your Honor, I think the presumption still applies even in that circumstance. And I think you're still just looking at it with the objective question of reasonableness. And especially in the facts of this case, you're looking at it in light of the fact that, when we're touching on the fact of them being afraid of opening the door to this Saddock incident. I mean,
didn't some of the members already know about that incident?
Well, Your Honor, Captain Imperial discussed that in depth about what they did or did not know, but the basics is that none of them knew any particulars about the stabbing incident. Nobody really knew anything specific. They'd all heard, the ones who'd heard about anything, heard about it through rumor or secondhand hearsay. And as Captain Imperial discussed, the defense counsel did a very good job during voir dire. You know, the next question on voir dire was after, when they were asking about their knowledge of the stabbing incident, do you believe everything you hear in the news? And then everybody to a person said, no, I don't believe everything I hear in the news, or I don't believe all the scuttlebutt that I hear around the office. And so it raises the implication, I think, you know, plants that seed in the panel member's mind who may have heard something that this may not be true.
What do we do with the fact that four of the five witnesses that we're talking about here weren't on the witness list the day before the stabbing?
Right, and defense counsel makes the argument
which certainly indicates that they weren't intended to be called at all.
Potentially, Your Honor. And I think that we have to look at the timing of when all this information came out, when the witness lists were submitted. You know, defense counsel have not addressed that issue in particular in their affidavits. But what I think you can glean from this is the reality. They state that after the stabbing incident, you know, they contacted some of their experts. I believe they talked to Dr. Woods. They definitely talked to Dr. Walker about it. Dr. Woods told them to stay the course.
But isn't it a little disingenuous to now argue that those individuals didn't testify because of the stabbing incident, when in fact they weren't even on the list before the stabbing incident?
But I think it just depends on how closely you read their affidavit. And I think part of the idea is we interviewed all the witnesses, and what they're pointing out is...
Well, put their affidavits aside. I'm just talking about what the defense did. I mean, they weren't on the witness list. Then the stabbing occurred. And now, or at that point, the defense is saying it was because of the stabbing incident, we couldn't rely on them.
Right, and I don't think that that's necessarily dispositive, because what defense counsel is saying is that we re-interviewed all these civilian witnesses, and many of them have had issues with the stabbing incident. And the fact that they weren't on the witness list right before the stabbing isn't necessarily dispositive, because as you can see, there were multiple iterations of the witness list, and there were changes to it. And it could have been that the defense counsel were trying to figure out, well, what do we have left after the stabbing?
Were those witnesses on the witness list prior to the day before the stabbing?
I believe that there were some who were on the witness list the day prior to the day before. I can't, off the top of my head right now, I can't remember the specifics, but there were some that were on it before, had been removed at some point. Some of them were never on a witness list, but were known by the defense counsel.
Obviously. What's the objectively reasonable argument for giving members a 313-page diary without any context, other than perhaps the mitigation specialist's notes?
Right, and the first point would obviously be, we disagree that there was no context. The first point would be Deborah Gray's analysis in the notes.
So I'm going to members and I say, here's a bunch of paperwork, please review it.
Right, and the
powerful stuff.
The FBI analysis of the diary.
Ordinarily, when documents are introduced, you tell people what the document is and that why they should look at it, and in particular, which page they should look at and that sort of thing. Am I missing something? They did not do that in this case, did they?
No, Your Honor. They did not do a, hey, I want you to focus on page 200 of the diary or anything of that nature. And I believe that was the reason. That was their goal, was they didn't want to focus on any particular package.
Yes, just give them a telephone book and say, here.
Well, not the idea of a telephone book, Your Honor. It's
tell me why it's objectively reasonable to present documentary evidence in that manner in this context.
Right, Your Honor. And there are a number of different reasons why the admission of the diary in the way it was objectively reasonable. The first is, and the defense counsel felt, they described this in their affidavit, that the most damaging aspects of the diary had already been admitted during the MIPS. And that's what the government admitted, those statements, essentially stating that when I get to Kuwait, I'm going to kill as many of them as I can. I have to make a choice whether or not I want to kill my Muslim brothers or my battle buddies. These are statements essentially stating the plan in the weeks before the murder that he's planning to do this. So these are clearly the most aggravating aspects of the diary. But there are, and as defense counsel point out, there are other aggravating statements occurring anywhere between 5 and 10 years earlier from the incident, statements about death to America or things of that nature. The defense counsel were aware of all these statements, and what they stated in their affidavit is they understood all this. They understood the pros and cons of the diary, and they made a strategic decision that the mitigating aspect of the diary overwhelmed those aggravating statements.
No, I understand. Now, my question is not why would you want the whole document in, but why would you want the whole document in without presenting any context?
Because of the fact, Your Honor,
or saying just what you just said. That might be useful.
Right, Your Honor, because of what Dr. Woods, beginning with Dr. Woods testifying that you have to look at the diary as a whole. So what defense counsel are trying to say is we're not going to focus on any particular statement. We want you to read the entire diary. And what they say is that it gives a unique look into appellant's mind. And even appellant's post-trial mitigation specialist states that even a cursory review of the diary shows someone with severe depression. And what they wanted you to do is just to read the diary. And there's no reading of the diary that a layperson is going to be able to come away with that isn't going to show some level of mental disturbance on the part of appellant. And that's what they were going for. They wanted it to support the idea that he is mentally disturbed. And that the
and
way
did they say that?
Yes, they did. And that's what they say in their affidavit.
No, that's what they say in their affidavit. Well, what did they say to the members?
Yeah, I mean, how are the members going to read something, lay people, and say, oh, that's reflective of depression?
And I believe that that's what they do say in sentencing. They talk about the fact this is a unique look at appellant's mind and look at the fact of what it shows, and it supports everything that Dr. Woods has already testified to. And I think that there are reasons why you don't necessarily call witnesses to try to analyze the diary, because you have to look at the context of when this was presented. This was presented at the beginning of the defense sentencing case. So at that point, the merits were already done. Appellant has already been convicted of killing two people and attempting to murder 16 others. The government has already completed its sentencing case, so absent the defense opening the door to something on rebuttal, the government is done. The government is presenting no additional evidence. If the defense puts the diary in and then calls an expert to come in and talk about all the different passages and try to put them in context as defense says should have been done, at that point, now you give the government the ability to come up and cross-examine those witnesses and focus specifically on those statements that they want to focus on.
And what's wrong with that? That's the way our system works.
Sure, but then
which then gives the panel both sides of the story. It lays it out for them.
Sure, Your Honor, but the defense, by only presenting the diary in the way they did, presented that the government's side from really being effectively pointed out. I mean, they were able to argue it in sentencing, yes, and that was obviously the danger. But the defense's idea was, let's try to limit that to the greatest extent possible. Had they called these witnesses, the government would have then had two opportunities, both in their sentencing argument, which they had regardless. But now they would have had the ability to examine witnesses and potentially argue that they could call their own witness on rebuttal to put their own context and spin on the diary, which would have been additionally damaging at that point. And I think that this is one of those pieces of evidence that, you know, the courts talk about, these double-edged swords, that this is what we leave to the discretion of counsel to decide whether or not they believe that that type of evidence should be admitted.
Okay, counsel, let's assume for a moment that it was appropriate, A, to introduce the entire diary, and B, to do it with no more contextualization than what was done at this trial. What about the fact that trial defense counsel did not get an instruction from the military judge to the panel saying, go back into the deliberation room, you must read this document? Instead, it was left very vague about what they were supposed to do with this, and they were permitted to take this document home with them. We don't know, as we sit here today, whether those panel members read this material, do we?
We don't for a fact, Your Honor. But I think that it's reasonable to conclude that they would have read it. I mean, the judge provided them this evidence, gave them the night off and the day off. I think they broke it just before noon on the day, and they reconvened the next morning. So they had the entire day to read all the documentation. I believe that while there may not have been I can't remember exactly, which there may not have been a specific instruction, you will sit down and read this. I believe that at least the implication was that they were supposed to take it home and read it, and that's why they were taking it home with them. So to think that a panel of officers and senior enlisted personnel would not have actually read anything that they were provided, I think, you know, it's too far of a stretch. Especially with the, you know, the presumption that the panels follow instructions of the military judge and they consider the evidence. I think the fact that they were given the evidence, this court can at least presume that they read it. And I think that that is what the defense counsel wanted to happen, was for them to read it from cover to cover. And they don't need an expert opinion as to how to read the diary and to contextualize, well, this statement means this or this statement means this. They just wanted to get the idea that read it from cover to cover, and what you were going to see, as has been said, a cursory review of this is going to show this level of mental illness. And that's what they wanted to come away with from the diary, which would further support what Dr. Woods had already laid the groundwork for his mental illness, to show that this person is not completely right. And that's really all they needed to show, because all they wanted to prove was that appellant was not mentally put beyond the fact that not mentally capable of forming the medication. At this point, the fact that he was not mentally right upstairs was the underlying theme that he doesn't deserve to be put to death. And that's what their overall strategy was to present this at this point. And that's what the diary assists with. Even though it has aggravating stuff, which, you know, may not be as aggravating as defense counsel likes to put forth. I mean, at this point, we also have to remember, he's just been convicted of murdering two people and attempting to murder 16 others.
What was the reason for not having mitigation specialists testify at sentencing?
Well, I think the question is, what would the mitigation specialist testify as to? And that really gets down to...
Well, they are people who are kind of trained to put this into context. They are also people who are experienced in testifying and won't be opening the door to improper cross-examination. And as I read the cases, I think the mitigation specialists typically testify in sentencing cases.
And sometimes they can. I believe Dr. Gray early on... Deborah Gray recommended against her testifying, just because of the dangers that could pose. And defense counsel were also concerned about dangers, you know, calling mitigation specialists. I believe they had experience in the past of having troubles when those individuals were called. But in particular to this case, I mean, the question is raised, what would they have actually testified to? And what would their import have been? What defense counsel and what appellant wants to point out and wants to argue is that the defense should have put on this humanity defense, this life story that should have come out, and that obviously could have come through a mitigation specialist. But what defense counsel made the tactical decision to do was to not present that testimony, because I believe it countered their overall strategy of mental illness. What appellant's counsel here stood up and talked to you about was this idea that we want to present this idea of this Nation of Islam, all this vitriol that his father had instilled in him at a young age, and all the radicalism that affected his entire life. The problem with that argument is that completely undercuts the mental illness defense. Instead of him killing these people based on a mental illness and his inability to comprehend what was going on, it's now based on this lifelong plan to of hatred of white people and Caucasians, and that his constant plan to kill people. That now puts into context the statements in the diary from 5 to 10 years before that he actually has been planning to do this for real. When you focus on the Nation of Islam and the radicalization of the Appellant, that becomes the story of the case and why he does this, not the mental illness.
Were there any witnesses who testified to why this was a life worth saving?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Like, explicitly testifying, I mean, there were statements.
No family member said, this is why you should spare this person's life.
I believe some of the statements that were admitted by the defense did touch on that.
Which statements were those?
I can't recall off the top of my head right now. I would have to look that up just for the which name it was on.
Does it strike you as unusual in a death penalty case to have no witness get up and indicate there was any basis to save someone's life?
Well, I think it's unusual, Your Honor, in this case, or in a death penalty case, not see family members be called. But I believe that there are reasons for that. I mean, I think we've talked about the stabbing incident, and the defense counsel point out they
you don't call a family member to say spare this person's life because they might indicate that there was a violent incident, which is already pretty self-evident.
Correct, Your Honor, but I mean...
This is a trial for a violent incident.
Correct, Your Honor, but I mean, I think when you look at the violent incident in question in this case, the stabbing occurring just weeks before the trial, I mean, I believe that that is potentially one of the most aggravating pieces of evidence that could come in. And the defense, we have to remember that the defense counsel's strategy at that point was to keep it out, and they did successfully keep it out. And so we have to look at the decisions made in light of that fact that the strategy was successful.
The strategy seems to be focused on preventing an assault coming in, but this is a death penalty case involving multiple murders.
But it's also an attempted murder at that point from the assault. I mean, he stabbed the guard in the neck with scissors. So, I mean, this wasn't just he punched someone. This was he tried to kill a guard in an escape attempt. So, I mean, I believe that this is extremely aggravating. And any idea
and therefore, don't bring in a family member to say this person has, there's some value to this person's life that should, and therefore spare it?
Well, I think what's key in this case is you have to look at the particular family members that could be called. I mean, Appellant himself even concedes that mother can never be called. And when we look at John Akbar as a potential witness, I mean, John Akbar should never be called as a witness.
Well, if we were to accept that the family members were unable to be controlled, why didn't they get letters from them as they did from his brother? I mean, what's the problem with that? To attempt to humanize him a little bit, which is the purpose of mitigation testimony.
And I don't know specifically, Your Honor. And those are obviously things that could have been done. But the question on under reasonableness, under Strickland, isn't that other strategies could have been pursued or other evidence.
But you just said, I don't know, but it's reasonable.
But I think an objective review of the record shows that it could be reasonable to not present those types of statements. I mean, I say I don't know because defense counsel didn't specify in a paragraph of the affidavit saying this is why we didn't present this. This is why Sergeant Akbar deserves to live.
So are you opening?
Go ahead.
So are you opening the door for a debate hearing?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe a debate hearing is required. I mean, a debate hearing is required where you have disputed questions of fact or conflicts between affidavits. And then, as we address in the brief in detail, there are no material questions of fact that are in conflict.
Well, isn't part of the problem here that both trial defense counsel were allowed to give one affidavit when we have more information if we had independent affidavits from these two trial defense counsel?
No, Your Honor, I think that there's considerable case law, and I think we addressed this in briefs below with the Army Corps, concerning the fact that courts routinely allow a single affidavits from multiple defense counsel. And there's really no question, I think, that's been presented that defense counsel have different opinions on things, that one may say one thing, one may say another. That's where you would obviously need separate affidavits. But I think what we have in this case, the facts are pretty clear that they all agree on what actually happened. I mean, we're just talking about a single specific point that was not addressed in an affidavit, which is obviously difficult to address every aspect. And I think Supreme Court case law, I can't remember, Penholster or Richter, which discusses the fact that the defense counsel is not required to explain every tactical decision that they made in the course of the trial. Courts can indulge that reasonable presumption and look at the objective reasonableness of particular strategies. So we can look at the reasons objectively why you may not want to put life sentencing testimony on. But even regardless of life-saving testimony on. But even regardless of whether or not it could have been presented, there's still no prejudice in this case. There's still no showing that would have been what carried the day and would have convinced the panel that he somehow...
What significance, if any, does the statement to the military judge that reconsideration has been proposed have in this case?
I believe it shows the fact, Your Honor, that, you know, contrary to appellant's arguments on appeal, his defense counsel were not so woefully inadequate that they abjectly failed their client during trial. What it shows is that the panel did struggle with the decision as to whether or not to sentence appellant to death.
Does that mean if one does get to Strickland prong two, the appellant wins?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I mean that's obviously the difficult question here with regard to the fact that obviously people struggle, and it's still a question of whether or not particular evidence would have swayed the panel. And we don't know why the panel would have decided one way or another. We're not allowed to question why they may have decided.
Did the military judge's instructions accurately indicate what might be going on? He said, don't tell me what's going on, but he then went through the various things that you'd take this number of votes to go up, this number of votes to go down. Is it the government's view that the military judge had that correct?
I believe so, Your Honor. I mean, I think that the predicate that he established was that a sentence had been reached. And so since a sentence had been reached, he gave the proper instructions detailing each of the vote requirements to open reconsideration. So I believe that was all correct. And then,
so an appellate court could infer that one or all of those things might have been going on.
Sure. Well, any of those things could have happened, Your Honor.
Okay. Isn't this a case, you know, this is certainly not a case in which trial defense counsel had an easy road to hoe, since their numbers were decapitated as the thing started, the facts, including the stabbing incident, aren't exactly helpful. Given all that, they do seem to exhibit a remarkable incuriosity about what they might have pulled out of some of these witnesses. There certainly were tactical reasons not to call some of these folks like mob, but still, they did a lot, but didn't they just skate over the surface here?
And Your Honor,
please answer the question fully.
I think the government would disagree with the idea that they went into this with this incuriosity. I believe that, you know, you have the affidavits where they describe that they interviewed all these witnesses and they went through their process of how they interviewed all these different civilian witnesses, and they would call them back to discuss after the mitigation specialist talked to them. You have the particular conflicts in which we addressed in the brief as to what may or may not happen and the effect it has on this case. But the overall idea is they came to a strategy, and they came to a trial strategy, that their focus was going to be on their claim that appellant was mentally ill. And this was going to be the focus of their case. And so this puts into context the statement at the point when Scott Murad is asking for additional time to conduct more mitigation investigation, where they're saying, look, I don't know what else we're going to get from this. The things that she's giving us are interesting in the abstract, but they don't really help the case. So all this information coming about his life history and his family history, that's coming from this mitigation investigation with the extended family and the multi-generational interviews which were conducted. What you get from that is that defense counsel understood that, read it, knew it was interesting, but it didn't necessarily support what they were trying to present, because they had a theme and they had a theory that they believed was the best chance to either find an acquittal or to at least...
Right, and your theory, and what you're arguing is that that's enough under Strickland.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. They had a theory based on full knowledge...
Even if something else might have worked better, that's not what Strickland requires.
Right, Your Honor. It's objectively reasonable under the presumption of competence of counsel and the presumption of the reasonableness. And so just because other evidence may have presented or other theories may have been employed, the answer is whether or not they chose an objectively reasonable one based on full knowledge of the facts. And that's what they did in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, you have the opportunity for your first round of rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. First, as to your question, sir, we would ask you to look at AE-12, page 223 of our brief. We believe the military judge had to explain to...
Would you say the number again?
AE-12 and page 223 of our brief, Your Honor. We'll explain the issue of the gates and why we believe that the military judge had a duty to instruct to go through the gates again. Judge Olson, you asked a question about mitigation and whether you can present something that's harmful. Sears v. Upton and Taylor v. Missouri, two cases where the courts warned counsel, you can't avoid all damaging information. There's going to be damaging information. These are capital cases, after all, that in almost every case there's going to be some terrible family structure, some terrible damaging in an ordinary sense, information out there, but that is indeed what litigation is. And that's what capital qualified counsel understand, is that what appears to be damaging in the ordinary case is actually litigation. The diary, several questions about that. As the experts say, guideline 10.11, Johnson v. Mitchell, Coddington, you could run through a number of cases, live testimony is always more compelling. And what happened in this case was what happened in Turpin v. Lippum, which is a case from Georgia that we cite in our brief, where the panel was given a bunch of stuff to go through. And as the court found there, they're just as likely to go through that bunch of stuff and pick out aggravating information as mitigating information. And there's much more aggravation in the diary than mitigation. So that's exactly what the counsel allowed the panel to do in this case. Judge Stuckey, regarding Donna Sachs, at 2800 and 2801, she specifically counters everything that trial defense counsel says regarding the meetings with Sergeant Akbar. She says that she met with him five times. He was memorable because he was so disturbed that he actually did seek help. It's something that many psychologically damaged people don't do. She found him significant for that reason. She never said that she had to have her memory refreshed. It wouldn't be surprising if she did even. That's what lawyers do, is refresh memory and try to find facts. That's entirely what would have been expected in any event. But she saw him for a period of time. There was a panel question asking, did Sergeant Akbar ever go to seek help while he was in college? Dr. Woods apparently didn't know the answer because he said no. The answer to that question from a panel member, did he seek help in question in college, was indeed yes, he did. And we have this information right here that counsel either didn't understand the significance of or didn't know about, that appellant went to see Dr. Sachs and was actually able to be treated, and actually she said he was doing better. So he had really rehabilitative potential for his mental health while he was in college. That is powerful, powerful evidence. If you have it, do you have to use it? Well, this court said in Alves, it depends, but generally you should look to use it. And it also Porter v. McCollum, another case where the defense counsel had the information, weren't curious enough, just wanted to skate over the surface of the case, and did not actually dig in and use the information. That's exactly what we have in this case. We had no witness come in and plead for Sergeant Akbar's life. As the Coddington case out of Oklahoma says, that is one of the most powerful forms of evidence in a death penalty case, is actually to have, in that case it was a mother, in this case we would have had a father come in and plead for his son's life, along with two other witnesses that weren't interviewed by trial defense counsel, Mushayat and Sultana, two sisters, not even interviewed by defense counsel. How can counsel determine information they're not controllable if they never interviewed them? And there's nothing in the mitigation notes that indicates they were not controllable either. Without a doubt, trial defense counsel did not interview any civilian witnesses before this trial began. The two counsel that argued that tried this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes part one of the oral argument. We will now take a 10-minute break and reconvene in 10 minutes. I can't, the clock is reflected, but 10 minutes from now, at a random time. 10 of, please. Thank you very much.
Court's in recess until 10:50 a.m.